Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with another day of manufactured drama and reality TV promotion, which turned into a tease in as much as President Trump did not declare a national emergency on the border today, but told us to stay tuned for the next episode of The Chaos Presidency. James Fellows, an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic, where his latest article is "The Networks Blew the Call," once again broadcasters prove hapless in the face of Trump's three familiar tools, joins us. We'll discuss today's whipsawing of the media by the distractor-in-chief and the human cost of Trump's latest stunt, the government shutdown. With today's demonstrations in the nation's capital by government workers who are either furloughed or, starting tomorrow, Friday, will not be getting a paycheck, we'll assess what will happen on the front line of this supposed crisis when the Border Patrol don't get paid tomorrow. And since James Fellows is a veteran private pilot, how safe the crowded skies are now that air traffic controllers are working without pay in a stressful job under the added stress of not being able to pay the bills. Then we'll look into the speech today in Cairo by Secretary of State Pompeo, a venue which was deliberately chosen since Obama made an important speech there on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, as did Condoleezza Rice before him. Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia and has an article at the New Republic, "How About Some Candor in Middle East Policy," joins us. We'll discuss Pompeo's trashing of Obama in what appears to be a requirement in the Trump White House, with the sycophantic Pompeo clearly pleasing his boss today. We will also explore what Pompeo meant when he vowed that, quote, the U.S. would expel every last Iranian boot from Syria. Then finally, we will speak with Jim Manley, a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate, where he served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years of his tenure and, before that, served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. He joins us to discuss the growing pressure on the Republican leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, to do his constitutional duty to stop being Trump's lackey and open up the government as the House sends bills his way every day to do so, and as more and more of his caucus defect to the Democrats' position. And joining us now is James Fellows, an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He previously worked as President Carter's chief speechwriter and was editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on the media and politics include Who Runs Congress? Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest book, China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. And he has an article at The Atlantic, "The Networks Blew the Call. Once again, broadcasters prove hapless in the face of Trump's three familiar tools." Welcome to Background Briefing, James Fellows.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to talk to you again.
Well, thank you, James. And obviously, we've been whipsawed today. We were waiting all day for the tease from President Trump that he would probably be declaring a national emergency. But as he said apparently the other day to the news anchors of the major network TV and news programs, that one, he didn't want to do the national broadcast, which he looked kind of sour when he was doing it, and two, he didn't want to go to the border. But he did sort of turn it into a reality TV promotion in which, you know, which he turned into a tease in as much as he's going to, you know, told us to stay tuned, that the border will be closed soon. So This is government by stunt. This is a distraction, obviously, and the biggest distraction of all being the border, closing the government down. But when do you expect him to actually pull the trigger on a national emergency?
So, you know, of course, the answer is with anything involving Trump is who knows, predictions are risky. And I've come to believe the sort of latest round of analysis, which is that if Trump declares an emergency, it's because he knows it'll be instantly challenged in the courts. He'll probably get various injunctions and stays. And so it's the one face-saving way for him out of this disaster that he's inflicting on nearly a million workers and all other parts of the American economy and society. But it's the way that he can avoid doing the one thing that is anathema for him, which is seeming to lose, especially losing to a woman in the form of Nancy Pelosi. So Who knows whether this will actually happen? I think if it does, it would be an instinct on the Trump White House's part to say, okay, how can we get out of this when there's no other apparent escape route?
Well, clearly he's boxed himself in. But if he were to do what he said he would do, and a lot of people expect him to do it today, and he didn't, and I don't know who's advising him against it, but I don't see any other way out for him. And if indeed he can find some pots of money with the Army Corps of Engineers and out of the Pentagon and turn our soldiers into construction workers, then he can turn around, surely, and say, okay, the wall is off the table now. It's up to the Democrats to open up the government.
And you would think that if, well, I'll put it a different way. It seems to me from a distance that all Trump cares about in this is some outcome that allows him to seem strong. And you recall, all your listeners will recall, that in the previous 2 years when the Republicans had big majorities in the House and workable majorities in the Senate, they could have funded this wall if they actually cared about it. And I think the analysis that what Trump really wants is to be seen as fighting for it, as opposed to actually getting it. I think that is the correct one. So if there's some way he can have some result that he can spin as saying, well, yes, I won. These Democrats, of course, they had to back away. We're getting the wall. And that whatever the actual reality is doesn't matter that much, as long as he can say, yes, once again, I fought and I have won.
Well, tomorrow, though, the Border Patrol don't get their paychecks if the government is still shut down. So, and we know that deeper you get into January, the more people will be expecting their IRS refunds. So he's getting into more and more dangerous territory. So I don't see how much longer he can be responsible for the shutdown, even though he's tried to blame the Democrats for something that he said he would proudly do and take the mantle for.
Probably and happily was the way he put it, you know, almost exactly a month ago tomorrow. And I think that it's been an interesting shift in the sort of mainstream media coverage, the TV coverage and the main news outlets in the past 3 or 4 days of treating this not simply as a political standoff in D.C., but the real effect in two ways. One is the real effect on actual families who, you know, are suddenly, they, like most Americans, have been gauging their cash flow and their credit card payments and their mortgage payment to a certain expectation of when money would be coming in and what it means to them to suddenly have the money not coming in. As a side note, the chief White House economic advisor about an hour ago on the PBS NewsHour, this is Kevin Hassett, was saying, well, actually these government workers are going to be better off because when this is all over, they will have had vacation without taking their vacation days, and they'll get their back pay. And sort of the Marie Antoinette-ishness of that is quite breathtaking. So there's been more and more coverage of that. The other is the ripple effects of damage in the national parks and the fact that there's no IPOs going on anymore because the Securities and Exchange Commission is not allowed to function and that the Weather Service can't update things. The National Transportation Safety Board can't conduct investigations. And I think there's more and more press attention on this actually matters, both to the people who are being furloughed and to the way that a country functions, food safety inspections, too.
And again, I'm speaking with James Fellows, an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He previously worked as President Carter's chief speechwriter and was an editor of U.S. News and World Report. And his books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress? Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, and his latest, China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. And he has an article at The Atlantic, The Networks Blew the Call. Once again, broadcasters prove hapless in the face of Trump's three familiar tools. So, of course, the networks they were right, weren't they, in terms of their misgivings? It wasn't so much a national broadcast, you know, in the FDR tradition with real crises. He turned it into a campaign speech and sent out a fundraising letter before and after the speech.
There are two silver linings I can see from this, and here I'm speaking as somebody who actually once wrote these kind of addresses long ago for Jimmy Carter in the White House when he was doing these fireside chats on energy policy and other things of that sort. One silver lining is that I think the networks may be, and by the networks I mean including the cable broadcast and all the rest, they may be slower to rise to this bait again when they realized how they were used. The other is it revealed the very different modes in which Donald Trump performs on TV. The way in which he is strongest is when he can build on a crowd's enthusiasm, verve, bloodlust, whatever you want, and he can see what the crowd is responding to and you know, rise that way. When he's just talking to the camera, he was not very good. He's not good at reading from teleprompter. It was clear that he had not seen this text before he was actually saying it, and so I think that the whole event, it's not that Pelosi and Schumer were that magnetic on TV either, but he was in the same, you know, bracket as Pelosi and Schumer, which he's not when he's giving one of these arena speeches.
Well, I must say, when I heard Pelosi and Schumer on the car radio, and they sounded good, but then when I saw the clips on TV, I was appalled. I thought, my God, you know, couldn't they get a bigger podium? I mean, it feels like the Democrats need Michael Deaver.
Oh, it is. Well, Michael Deaver was big at getting flags into TV with Ronald Reagan, and they certainly absorbed that part of the lesson. There were like 100 flags behind them.
Right.
But it was, you know, I'm not a TV expert, but you think there would have been some easier way to have them seem more natural. But still, the fact that they and Trump seemed to be on sort of the same level of being able to appeal to the crowd was objectively a victory for them, because Trump, when he's whipping it, when he's giving like a convention speech, that is when he's at his oratorical most ominous.
Right, and it turns out that in spite of the fact that they kind of, Pelosi and Schumer looked like a strange version of the American Gothic in front of this tiny little podium that they're crowding themselves behind. They got higher ratings than Trump did.
And that you can imagine the people in the White House trying to make sure that information did not get in front of Donald Trump.
Right.
Who would want to be the one to tell him that?
Right. Well, I mentioned a minute ago, James Fellows, that starting tomorrow, the Border Patrol, who are on the front line of this supposed crisis, are not going to get paid. And we want to know that the Coast Guard is not getting paid. And they're that's the waterborne part of our border, if you will. But what about, you're a veteran private pilot, and the last time we spoke was about your book, about you and your wife traveling across the United States in your plane, stopping at every little airport along the way and giving us a flavor of the America between New York and California. Clearly all along the way, you were dealing with air traffic control. And now we have crowded skies, and we have air traffic controllers who are working in, saving aircraft from colliding in these crowded skies, working without pay in a stressful job under the added stress of not being able to pay the bills.
Yes, and I've been talking a lot to air traffic controllers and some TSA people in the past week, and I think both of these things are true. Probably there is not an actual increased risk of a crash. I know, God spare there being any crash, because, you know, they're so catastrophic when they happen, because the system is so laden with redundant safety protections. But what will happen, I think is already happening, is because the TSA workers, the air traffic controllers, the dispatchers, everybody else, they're not getting paid, they're on furlough, they're having to show up, and they'll see when they get paid later on. They are slowing everything down, not in kind of a work slowdown way, but just making sure they don't make mistakes. So the TSA lines are already longer and will be getting longer still. The delays in routing in and out of airports will increase. And so just the kind of gumming downness of the system will be more and more evident as a safety measure. They're under additional strain. They don't want to make mistakes. And so the way to do that is to make sure that they have more time for everything, which means that everything will take longer in the air travel system.
So since you've worked in the White House and been a veteran journalist, obviously, the Trump is so different. That's an extremely polite way of putting it. And in terms of the White House, there's never been anybody like this in the Oval Office. That's certainly extraordinary. And to some people, it's a virtue, particularly to his base. And I just don't know how long that'll last, whether at some point they might want some professionalism and some dignity. But in terms of the press, how do we deal with being whipsawed and co-opted every day to be a part of this reality TV distraction? Because we're just absolutely complicit in which is this constant fraud on the American people by this guy who doesn't have a clue how to govern, but just governs by daily stunt to distract us from the fact that he doesn't know how to govern.
I agree with the premise of your question, and I think that perhaps the stunt at the border now, following the stunt of the past 3 months with this alleged caravan menace that all evaporated after the election, and the stunt of this Oval Office speech, which was about nothing, this may finally, we could pray, have some effect on the TV, the network and cable TV sources, just to say, do not put this guy on live. That if you put him on live, it's like pro wrestling, or it's like the O.J. car crash or something, chase or something, which has short-term spectacle value, but which is objectively making people stupider as time goes on, and is objectively the main thing Trump has going for him, that he would certainly not have become president if CNN and others had not covered his speeches wall-to-wall in 2015 and 2016. So maybe we can all hope that this awareness will be coming into the mind of TV producers to say, we have been whipsawed. It's bad for the news media. It's bad for the country. It's bad for the world. And let's impose some cautionary or conscious laden break on whether we respond to whatever. You know, it's like a cat with a laser pointer. Sort of, if you think of the press as being a cat and Trump holding the laser pointer and going from wall to wall, that's what he's been able to do. And I think I hope there will be some resistance.
And just in closing, you've just pointed out the opposite in a way, James Fellows, that when he is scripted in the teleprompter, it doesn't work.
Yes. So. It is. It's true. I mean, and you know yourself, Ian, that reading from a prompter is not as easy as it seems. And it's different from getting up there and sort of leading rally cheers. It's a learnable skill that people have to master, and it's something that he has not wanted to master. And so maybe the more prompter speeches he gives, the better, and that they'll have declining ratings.
Right. And, of course, Bill Clinton, when he gave a State of the Union, they loaded the wrong speech into the teleprompter, and yet he was able to deliver the original speech that he'd written with the old speech in front of him. So that was an amazing performance. I thank you for joining us, James Fellows.
Ian, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with James Fellows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He previously worked as President Carter's chief speechwriter and was editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on the media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, and his latest, China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. And he has an article at The Atlantic, The Networks Blew the Call. Once again, broadcasters prove hapless in the face of Trump's three familiar tools.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He has served on projects in more than two dozen countries, including Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Egypt. And he's lived and worked in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and Egypt for the National Institute of International Affairs. And in 1995, he was a Fulbright Scholar in Amman, Jordan, where he conducted research on the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan. An Arabic speaker, he is the co-author of The Prosperity Agenda, and he has an article at The New Republic, How About Some Candor in Middle East Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Katulis.
Thanks for having me.
So instead of candor today in Cairo, a venue that was deliberately chosen by Secretary of State Pompeo because President Obama had made a very important foreign policy speech about the Middle East in Cairo early in his presidency, and Condoleezza Rice prior to that had also made an equally important speech about Bush foreign policy in the Middle East before him. So no doubting that that was there was a deliberate choice there. And instead of really explaining American foreign policy, as far as I could tell, I watched a lot of the speech and read the transcripts, and he spent most of his time trashing Obama. But the amazing part was he started out the speech by talking about the Bible that he keeps in a small wood-paneled office on the seventh floor of the State Department, his own Bible. And he ended the speech to a largely Muslim audience by, invoking the Lord's blessing. What's going on there? I mean, I'm just dumbfounded.
Well, as we know, Mike Pompeo is a religious Christian, and he wears his faith on his sleeve. But this speech, you know, I'm glad you're doing a segment on it, but frankly, I think in the next few days, nobody will remember it. It was completely overtaken by events in the United States with the shutdown and the big debate there. But in the Middle East, in my discussions with friends in the region, not many people paid attention, and in part because I think they knew what to expect from Pompeo, which was pandering rather than actually some hard truths. But the growing perception, and I go to the Middle East regularly, is that America is just not interested. They see conflicting messages and movements on the part of the Trump administration in Syria and in other places, and it's just kind of a sideshow. So we could parse like statements or things that he says, what Mike Pompeo says, but the bigger issue is America's done with the Middle East by and large. I mean, people aren't interested in it, and the Middle East is done with America. And I think that's the bigger dynamic that didn't begin with Trump. I think the overreaches of Iraq and what President Obama tried to do. So this is a bit of a sideshow, if you understand my view. It's an incoherent approach in policy, and the words don't mean that much.
Well, as I say, Brian Katulis, he did spend most of his time trashing Obama, and I'm not sure that's not a requirement in the Trump White House. And we know that Pompeo was totally sycophantic. So I'm assuming that he pleased his boss with what he said. But the one thing that did at least get a headline and some attention was his statement that the U.S. would expel every last Iranian boot from Syria. What did you make of that?
Again, words are cheap. You actually have to have a policy to back it up. And in essence, since 2011, since the civil war began in Syria, we've now had two administrations say that they were going to do certain things in Syria, and they just didn't do it. So when I go to the region and I talk to people who are managing Syria policy in places like Israel or Jordan, right next door to Syria, they don't get a clear signal from the Trump administration and the United States in terms of what its goals are. And there's a reason for that. There are just so many different voices inside of the Trump administration that are saying different things, but actions speak louder than words. And except for a few strikes, military strikes, on the part of the Trump administration in response to chemical weapons use, the U.S. really hasn't done anything. So I don't expect that what Pompeo said about expelling every last Iranian is actually backed by any policy at all. And it contradicts what his own boss, President Trump, said just a few days ago when he said, oh, Iran can do what it wants in Syria. So if you hear those two statements and then you don't see any policy, you're going to conclude that the U.S. is not likely to do anything in Syria that matters.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering why we're having the conversation if we're talking about nothing. But it's,
yeah, I am too, quite frankly. And, you know, I've studied and lived in the Middle East, and this is how dire it is when it comes to U.S. policy right now. We are talking about nothing, nothing that's coherent. I talk regularly also to people who serve in this administration, people who are responsible for things like Syria policy or Iraq policy. And you know what? They're waiting for the next tweet to drop, an unexpected decision by their boss, President Trump. And that state of affairs in terms of how the U.S. government is run is a travesty. And the thing we should be talking about is that bigger picture, that all of this, not speeches, you know, it's fine to talk about speeches, but the bigger problem is the lack of any policy or a credible administration that really is doing anything to advance U.S. interests. It's sort of, you know, a show, and it's kind of parallel to what we're seeing on the handling of this immigration issue as well.
Right, and not only was the venue chosen because of Obama's speech, and he took advantage of the venue to say, Obama told you that radical Islamist terrorism doesn't stem from ideology. He told you 9/11 led my country to abandon its ideals, particularly in the Middle East. He told you that the United States and the Muslim world needed a new beginning, and the results of these misjudgments have been dire. No mention, of course, of Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld's disastrous Iraq war, the disastrous war in Afghanistan that's about to go into its 18th year, an extraordinarily selective piece of history, I would say.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I used to live in Egypt and have many friends in Egypt, and you know what? They don't care. Everything that you just said right now, what do they care about? They don't truly care what Mike Pompeo or even President Trump says these days. They care about whether their economy is going to improve, whether their lives are going to improve. And the U.S., by and large, is irrelevant to that for the most part. Again, that's the bigger picture here, that this speech, I think to me, and the fact that it won't be remembered or even talked about in a few days, is symbolic of what I think has been the trajectory of U.S. policy in the Middle East and where it's actually headed. It's that it's a lot of noise and sound and fury signifying nothing.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He served on projects in more than two dozen countries, including Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Egypt, and lived and worked in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, in Egypt, and was a Fulbright scholar in Amman, Jordan. And he's an Arabic speaker, and he's the co-author of The Prosperity Agenda, and he has an article at The New Republic, How About Some Candor in the Middle East. So if these people in the White House weren't so amateurish, so sycophantic, you know, having to sort of please this narcissistic, incompetent, their boss, you know, there's nobody left now to stand up for whatever you're saying. There is no American foreign policy. U.S. has made itself irrelevant in the Middle East. If that were a deliberate strategy, that may not be such a bad idea, in as much as, you know, Obama tried to get out from under the Middle East, did he not? The idea that we've spent so much treasure and lost so many lives in pursuit of these ridiculous missions and tragedies. And meanwhile, you know, China is a rising power, with whom we have some problems. So in that broad context, how do you explain, one, the need to reevaluate how long we've been in the Middle East? And I think a lot of it has to do with our dependence on oil and the idea that maybe the big picture is in the Asia-Pacific region.
I think all of that is true, but it's also not a new idea. President Obama talked about it, and here's the issue. He talked about it. He talked about a pivot to Asia and pulling back from the Middle East. He started to make those moves, and then he stopped. And why did he stop? He stopped for a couple of reasons. How we get out of places like Iraq is terribly important, and the way that we left Iraq, and I was a advocate of getting out of Iraq as quickly as possible, but how we did it actually contributed to the rise of ISIS. I'm not saying Obama created ISIS like Trump says, but the fact that we left the situation in such a chaos created problems that drew us back in. The Syria civil war, for all of the talk that we should just isolate Syria and contain the effects of its civil war, the reality is when historians look back on the political impact of millions of refugees flooding from Syria into European countries, the threat of ISIS, the videos of Americans getting beheaded, all of that changed politics back here in 2014 in a massive way. And I argue led to the reemergence of the politics of fear that Donald Trump exploited and actually won the presidency on. So, look, people like to live in the fantasy world, and increasingly many Middle East analysts here in Washington and pundits in the media like to say, okay, we could just leave and minimize our costs. And I'm in favor of right-sizing that. But how you do it and how you get it right and manage those risks is very important. And instead, we have this sort of lazy, hyper-political debate where, you know, Trump is in favor of something and people are against it. And what I'm saying is we need to think through, how do we actually turn the page on what has essentially been 40 years of America's overinvestment in the Middle East and do it in such a way that recognizes that there will be risks, there will be problems, we can manage those, but you need to actually have a plan to minimize those risks. That's not the discussion we're having, and frankly, you know, even on a day like today, and I'm glad you're doing this segment on Pompeo's speech, but people just aren't talking about the Middle East. They're talking about the fact that we can't even keep our government open here at home. And I'll tell you one last thing is that simple fact that our Republicans and Democrats and Trump can't get together on some of our own basic issues makes us even less credible in the eyes of people in the Middle East and in Asia and in other places as being some sort of leader that matters. And that's, to me, the bigger story of today. Not that Pompeo gave a speech that nobody will remember, but that, in fact, we look like buffoons and clowns in the face of the world because we can't take care of issues that are closer to home along our border.
And Brian Katulis, could you add to that, though, that U.S. Foreign policy, for all of its faults and failures over the decades, particularly through the Cold War, at the end of the day, at least we stood for democracy. And there has been a real change with this leader we have, who seems to have much greater affection for despots than he does for democratic allies. There's just no question about it. Just the other day, he swooned over this beautiful letter that he got from Kim Jong-un, one of the world's most horrendous dictators. He's covering up for the MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, soon to be king. I don't know what's going on there. He's the only person in the world that appears not to believe that MBS ordered the grisly murder and dismemberment of a Washington Post journalist, Kamal Khashoggi. Today in Washington, there was, on the 100th day of Khashoggi's murder, there was a memorial for him where a lot of people talked about the need to protect journalists. Because Khashoggi was a journalist, and Trump doesn't seem to care about it. And then, frankly, when Trump talked about journalists and the press being the enemy of the people, that's music to the ears of Erdogan and Putin and Duterte and MBS and all of these despots around the world. So my sense is that in the broader frame, I know we talked about the Middle East versus Asia, but the broader frame, to my mind, is will frail democracies survive in this world as more and more criminally run kleptocracies seem to be taking over? And we have a president who seems to be more sympathetic to criminal kleptocrats than he does to embattled Democrats.
He's not only sympathetic to them, he runs his White House like one. I wrote an article a year or so ago that essentially said that Donald Trump runs his White House like a Middle East dictator does. He appoints members of his family in the government. He keeps some other members of the family in the family business so they can enrich themselves, like the kleptocracies around the world. He puts a lot of generals in positions where you don't need generals. And he also browbeats the media all the time. Guess what? When I lived in Egypt or when I traveled to places like Saudi Arabia, that's what happens. So he's not only sympathetic to that, he in a sense, models his own behaviors on it. You hear all of this talk of him potentially declaring some sort of national emergency. Egypt for decades had some emergency rule that was essentially the abuse of power on the part of the president. We're not that far away from that, my friend. Bigger issue on democracy is this trend, not only under Trump, of turning a blind eye to this regression away from freedom globally, meaning more and more countries are slipping back out of democracy into something that is more autocratic. This began in 2005 or 2006 at the height of Bush's freedom agenda. And quite frankly, President Barack Obama did nothing about it, absolutely nothing. The trends got worse around the world, and in essence, we downgraded human rights and democracy under President Obama, and Trump has taken it undoubtedly to new levels with his full embrace of all of these dictators. But the point I'm making is a broader one, and I think it's in part because of the overreaches of the 2003 Iraq War and a number of other factors. Americans used to care about democracy and human rights, and by that I mean the broader American public. They used to debate this. And you know what? They're not anymore, and it's sad. It is a real loss, but it's also a danger, because if we ignore the abuses in other countries and we ignore the fact that there's similarities between how Trump operates back here at home with those autocrats overseas, the regression that we've seen in other countries could be coming here, and I think is, in many ways is already we've seen it manifested.
Well, Brian, we run out of time, but if Trump does declare a national emergency, that's right out of the autocrats' playbook. So
absolutely.
So
yeah. And again, nobody will remember Secretary of State speech in Cairo,
which I've covered to death. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it. And again, I've been speaking with Brian Katulis, as a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He served and worked in the Middle East for many, many years as an Arabic speaker. He's the co-author of The Prosperity Agenda, and he has an article at The New Republic, How About Some Candor in the Middle East Policy. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the growing pressure on the Republican leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jim Manley, a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years of his tenure, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Thanks, Ian, for having me on again.
Well, thanks, Jim. And frankly, I've been waiting around all day. Every day you get whipsawed by Donald Trump. It's very hard, more often than not, I have to call up people I've interviewed on tape and say, I'm sorry, I have to re-interview you because of something he's done. So I waited around today for him to pull the trigger on this national emergency on the border. It didn't happen, but I think it will happen. And he's more or less said it will happen. So let's start from that premise. What strategy should the Democrats have to counter what I think Trump was likely to do if he says, now that I've taken the wall off the table and the military are building it, turning around and turning it back on the Democrats and saying, now it's the Democrats' responsibility to open up the government?
Well, a couple different things. First of all, you asked me what Democrats should do. And the answer to that is that they should continue to do what they've been doing for the last couple of days. And that is to keep on passing these appropriations bills to open different parts of the government and send them over to the Senate for Senator McConnell to decide to do. While that is occurring, you know, they need to wait and see what the president's going to do. And if he does, in fact, go forward with this executive action, you know, they should prepare to get ready to deal with it in court. In the meantime, you know, the funding is going to be hung up. You know, he'll get a splashy ceremony, if you will, but there's going to be no action. And at some point, you know, things will get back to regular order and they'll sort out everything and let the courts decide. In the meantime, you know, he'll take another loss. He's not getting his wall.
Well, but if the Democrats keep sending these bills over to Mitch McConnell and he keeps refusing to deal with them, it does look as if McConnell, supposedly the deal maker, is getting more and more embarrassed.
That's my point, exactly. So tonight we saw 12 Republicans voted for the latest iteration of the appropriations bill at a time when Senate Republicans are getting more and more concerned about the situation at hand. Many believe, for better or for worse, that the best situation or the best option right now is for the president to move ahead, issue this executive action. It gets hung up in the court, but in the meantime, he can take a win, albeit a very hollow one, and, you know, the House and Senate can get back to doing, you know, what they're supposed to be doing. But we'll have to wait and see. As you suggested at the beginning, we're all being whipsawed, and this guy is, you know, governing from his gut, whatever the heck that means. And, you know, we're all just along for the ride. But more what I am watching for right now is more and more Republicans are getting at least a little bit antsy about this administration, this president, and the fact that he is, you know, absolutely unable to govern.
Well, to that extent, at least Nancy Pelosi has identified that as being the problem. I mean, along with the other problems, which are if you meet with President Trump, you don't have an agreed basis of facts because he can say anything because he's not grounded in facts, and he gets some of his information from Alex Jones and other lunatics. So it's hard to deal with him on the basis of having shared basic facts. It's also hard to deal with him.
I got to tell you, sorry to interrupt, but I got to tell you, I'm really glad that I'm not advising a member of the leadership right now, because this guy is flat out unable to govern and or legislate. His word is no good. He changes his mind at least a couple times a day based on the whims of Alex Jones, Fox News, or Breitbart. You know, this is, you know, it's, I feel sorry for Pelosi and Schumer, and I don't want to say that I feel sorry for McConnell, but, you know, if you can't trust a president, if the president's word is no good, you've got nothing. So in the meantime, you know, we're all, you know, watching this all go by, you know, in this crazy 24/7 news cycle we're currently in. So,
well, I was going to add to the fact, which you just pointed out, that if you do make a deal with him, the minute you're out of the Oval Office, he gets a phone call or he watches Fox and sees mm-hmm. Ann Coulter or Rush Limbaugh say something nasty, and he'll reverse himself on a dime. But then lately, Pelosi's been pointing out if there's a strategy there, the only strategy that Trump has is the strategy of distraction. That maybe he likes the chaos. Maybe the chaos is all that he knows.
That's all that he knows, and he thinks that he's got the maximum amount of leverage when things are spiraling out of control. But the reality is, he's just along for the ride, just like all of us. He's making up this fiction, this reality, living in it, and everybody else is facing the real world, consequences. You know, I just, to go back to what you said in the beginning, I mean, I just think it's so funny to hear Republicans saying, including the Vice President of the United States, saying Democrats should simply sit down and negotiate with this president. You know, give me a break. For better or for worse, Leader Pelosi and Senator Schumer tried that last year at the very beginning of his tenure. And as soon as they walked out of the Oval Office, he reneged on the immigration deal. And since then, he's proven wildly unreliable. And now he's, of course, reduced once again to issuing schoolyard bully chants, or, you know, he called Schumer crying Chuck again this morning in a tweet. He's still laying off Pelosi because he's smart enough to know that he doesn't want to go there with that lady. So it's just, again, I spent 21 years in the Senate. I've never seen anything like it. I worked for two senators that had to work with Republican presidents. It's doable. You know, that's the way it's supposed to work. But this guy is just absolutely unreliable, and no one in their right mind thinks that they can sit down and cut a deal with him.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Manley, a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the last 6 years of his tenure, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. So when Senator Chris Van Hollen says the pressure will build on McConnell because right now he has contracted out the whole Senate Republican caucus to President Trump and the White House, they're violating their constitutional duty. So I take it that's the Achilles heel, right? If there's a strategy.
That's the other part of the emerging strategy, which we discussed earlier. The first part is for the House to send appropriation bills over to the Senate. The second part is the Democratic caucus standing together and blocking action on any other bills until McConnell steps to the plate and helps negotiate a deal with this. With his president. Great move by the senator. I'm glad to see that most every Senate Democrat is in agreement with it, and I think they should consider it, continue to do it until Trump caves. So it's just people are getting hurt here. Every day the paper's got more and more stories about different agencies getting shut down, the FDA, lack of oversight of our food supply, et cetera. And this guy goes down to Texas today, once again brags about his wall, which he, by the way, he said Mexico was going to pay for. So,
well, what were the two Republican senators from Texas doing today with him on the border? Is there?
Well, I don't know what they're. Well, let's be clear. I don't know what they were doing. Well, I do know what they were doing down the border today. But more interesting is the news that's just being reported as we speak that the president is prepared to dip into some Army Corps of Engineers funding that has been set aside for the recent disasters in such places as, I don't know, Texas and Florida, for instance. I can't wait to see how the Republican senators from those states, along with California, Puerto Rico, and others, are going to react. No disrespect to the folks from Puerto Rico or California, but it'd be really interesting to see how what Senator Cornyn, for instance, says about the idea to take emergency funding away from his state. I don't think he's going to like it.
So, Jim Manley, back to the question of strategy vis-a-vis the Democratic-controlled House. If Trump throws it back at Nancy Pelosi, and I mean, if he declares a national emergency, which he seems to be more and more heading in that direction. In fact, I think he's painted himself into a corner where he doesn't really have too many other options. So if he declares it, tries to get the Pentagon, I mean, turn our soldiers into construction workers, which is pretty ridiculous, but let's just follow the scenario through. If he turns it back and tells his base that the wall's going to be built, and now that that's settled, it's off the table, it's now up to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to open up the government, what do they do then?
I'm not so sure that's how it's going to play out. Under that scenario, at least I think most people suggest that he will take the win and then work to try and reopen the government. You know, his base will believe anything, but in the meantime, you know, it's all going to be hung up in the courts for years to come. So, you know, he's bleeding badly from this, Ian. He wants a way out, so he doesn't want the government shut down forever. You know, he may talk like he does, but the reality is he's bleeding hard from it. So, I think the more likely scenario is that if he goes forward with that, you know, he'll crow to the base that he got the win. But in the meantime, you know, the actual issue is going to be hung up in the courts for months to come.
Well, first of all, he can say anything because he does say anything. He says that all the government employees that are out of work, and by the way, tomorrow, Friday, over 800,000 government workers won't get a paycheck, including the Border Patrol, I might add, on the front line. We already know that the other front line at sea, the Coast Guard, aren't getting paid as well. So since he is already saying that all those people support him, he'll say anything. So if he declares victory, he's also several times tried to switch from the time in the Oval Office where he took credit for shutting down a wall and said that it'll be on me, and now he's backed away and blamed the Democrats. I can't see him not doing anything else. We'll see.
I mean, again, he's wildly predictable. Let's definitely agree on that. But again, I contend that he's bleeding from this. He's hurting politically. And more importantly from him, he's losing support on the Hill, which he's going to need in the weeks and months to come as the oversight and investigation gear up. So, you know, maybe he's going to continue the fight. But again, I think if you look at his career, when he's backed into a corner, you know, he struggles to find anything, any way that he can find to declare victory. He takes a fig leaf and then he, you know, goes on to create another crisis. So.
Right.
And that's what I think is going to happen this time.
Sure, he's going to declare victory, and he may have a fig leaf, but as long as the government shut down, it's not a victory. So I'm trying to figure out how he's going to get out from under that.
The victory for him is getting the wall built. Again, whether it's going to be – Ian, that's old-style thinking. You're thinking that he's on the up and up. He doesn't care if the damn wall's built or not. He just wants to be able to say that it's going to get built.
Right.
Again, remember, this wall, as has been publicly reported, this was simply a device that he wanted to use on the campaign trail to remember to talk about immigration. He doesn't believe in it. There's no rational reason for it. There's no policy reason for it. The whole thing's a phony, made-up argument that he can use to exploit his base. So, you know, I wouldn't put too much into the stock that he actually believes all this. This is the kind of guy that just wants to be able to win and declare victory, you know, doesn't really care about the details.
Right. But let's assume then that he declares victory, that we're going to build a wall, and I'm sure he's going to say now it's up to the Democrats to open up the government. What do they do? I mean, that's the part of it that I don't, you know, who's going
to be? He's not getting his wall money.
Right. Well, he says he'll say he doesn't need it anymore. That's what this end runs about, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. So that's why, again, that's one of the reasons why I think that he would acquiesce to the government opening up again.
Oh, I see.
I just don't think.
In other words, the government is going to open up on Schumer and Pelosi's terms? Or will they go back?
He doesn't care about that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he doesn't care about funding levels, et cetera. I mean, you know, as far as he's concerned, remember, as far as he's concerned, we're on a budget path where the Pentagon gets a robust increase in spending. You know, he's cut some key agencies and others are getting them by just fine. You know, this current situation for Republicans is just fine. And then, you know, we've got a debt limit right around the corner, which you know, he may try and use to hold a hostage again. So, you know, he lives to fight another day kind of a thing.
Right.
You've got plenty of opportunities throughout the year to try and throw a monkey wrench into the system. I think he's desperate to try and get out of the situation he's currently in, which is why, again, if he goes forward with this executive action, he'll claim victory and live to fight another day.
Right. Well, I don't mean to be, you know, obtuse here, but I think since so much of it's about a blame game, about Trump trying to blame the Democrats for the government shutdown, and the Democrats trying to make it clear that this is Trump's shutdown because he said he would do it and he would take the mantle proudly. I'm trying to figure out, I know he's going to declare victory and basically say now it's up to the Democrats to open up the government, and that's the next step that I'm not clear about.
Yeah, well, again, I don't know what else to say except for, you know, he'll say that he got his wall, and so in order not to hurt, you know, average working men and women in this country, you know, he's going to allow the government to get up and running. Again, he's got a whole bunch of Republicans that are getting nervous about this. You know, his Pentagon with his generals, you know, they want an open government. They want full funding. I honestly think that's going to be enough pressure to get him to back off that.
Right. So in other words, So in other words, Jim, he's going to sign McConnell's bill, the CR that was passed.
Yes.
I see. And so we'll be back.
I believe that's where we're headed.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I just was trying to get a path here because it's so hard following government by stunt, you know.
It's absolutely almost impossible to do, no doubt about it.
So you forgive me for my obtuseness. I thank you for joining us, Jim.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley, a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years of his tenure. Before that, served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, disappeared by 9:30. Who'll ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here under the free. One time.